company needs a man in this position. Clients would rather deal with men when it comes to figures.
Oh, now we're getting at it. I lose a promotion because of some idiot prejudice. The boys in the club are threatened, and you're so intimidated by any woman that won't sit at the back of the bus.
Spare me the women's lib crap, okay? Now, I know how you feel, and I understand it.
You understand zilch.
I understand I'm still a boss here.
Three women get revenge on their sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot of a boss. This week, special guest Courtney Noah joins us to talk about keeping health insurance reps employed, being prejudiced against deer, and writing on one-ply toilet paper. Then we tumble out of bed, stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a gulp of ambition, and find out if 9 to 5 stands the test of time.
It's the test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? James says Gladiator with a glut. Says, as a father, blah blah. It's the test of time. James and Alan have to say, the movies you love still hold up today. Test of time. James and Alan have to say, the movies you love still hold up today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Test of Time. I'm James Brief, and joining me, as always, is Alan Noah. How are you doing, Alan?
I am doing very well. Thank you, James.
And tonight we actually have a real special guest. It's really interesting how you know this guest. How do you know this guest tonight, Al?
Well, we've been married for 13 years. Coming back to the show, it's Courtney Noah.
Hello. Thanks for bringing me back.
Of course. I mean, you're sort of an easy get because, you know, we're married.
And you're stuck at home with me right now.
Right. We've been stuck indoors together for the past 9 months. But there's no one I'd rather be stuck at home with than you.
Oh, how sweet.
And I'm not just saying that because we're recording. Maybe a little. No, just kidding. So today we're going to talk about 9 to 5. And this was a movie that you had requested a while ago. So why do you love this movie, Courtney?
Because it's about women sticking it to the man, you know? I really admire that about this movie.
And when you say the man, you're talking specifically about...
The man. The man. A man.
And this man represents...
All things evil in the business world, I would say.
There you go. And you are a successful professional woman. So do you relate to this movie? Is that fair to say?
I don't think I've seen such overt sexism, more of the kind of undertones of sexism or lack of females in the workplace in right. senior positions.
Yes, I was going to say, like, this whole office in this movie is filled with women, but they're all underlings under the men who have the real power.
Right.
I sort of got the impression that it's like that shield of like, well, of course I can't be sexist. I'm surrounded by women. I have tons of women everywhere. They all work for me, but then I can't possibly be sexist. You know, like that bullshit argument, basically.
Exactly. Yeah.
And James, what struggles with sexism have you faced in your professional career?
Well, I actually work in a mostly female industry or workspace, pediatrics. I currently work with all women.
And how is that? Do you find that they treat you with respect? Are they harassing you and pinching your butt all the time? Like, what do you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis?
Generally, my gender doesn't really come up day-to-day, but, you know, it's all good.
Good. That is good to hear. I've worked in places where I was the only male on the team and, you know, was harassed zero. But I have seen plenty of harassment in workplaces where there are women who are in the workplace, but their opinion counts just a little bit less for no reason other than there's a man who thinks that his opinion counts more. So, those themes are relevant. But we're not just talking about sexism in the workplace. We're talking about the movie 9 to 5. So, James, why don't you remind our listeners what this movie is all about?
This movie is about three women trying to succeed in a male-controlled corporate company. Their boss, Mr. Hart, treats all the women who work for him horribly. He sexually harasses them, he passes them over for promotions, steals their ideas, and even spreads rumors that he's sleeping with his secretary. When the women decide they've had enough, they kidnap their boss, implement some much-needed changes into the office, and teach Mr. Hart a thing or two about the modern world.
And by modern, you mean 1980.
Late 1980. This was released December 19th, 1980.
This movie came out 40 years ago. It's the anniversary. Was it a big hit? I don't remember because I was 1 year old.
You know, actually, in its opening weekend, it opened at number two with $3.9 million. It got killed by a Clint Eastwood film. But $3.9 million was its opening weekend, and it wound up grossing $103 million in the U.S. That is a 26 times multiplier.
Wow. So, yes, big hit then.
Yeah, it was a real big hit. It was actually the number two film of 1980. And I don't have to ask Al, but I'll actually ask Courtney with the hint that I don't have to ask Al what the number one film of 1980 was. Care to take a guess what 9 to 5 lost to?
I'll give you a hint.
Star Wars?
No.
Close. You're very, very close. You're very close.
Back to the Future? No.
No. It was the sequel. It was the sequel to the first one.
It's my favorite movie of all time.
Oh, Empire Strikes Back. Yeah, oh, a Star Wars movie, though, yes. Is what I meant.
Well, it wasn't Star Wars.
Okay, whatever.
It's close partial enough. Credit. Partial credit, Back to the Future, zero credit, but partial credit for Star Wars.
I lump all Star Wars movies as Star Wars.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. So this was a huge smash hit, second only to Empire Strikes Back. So when did you first see this movie, Courtney?
Oh, God. Well, I was a baby at the time, coming up on 1 year old. So I probably saw this on like one of those like Sunday afternoon at the movies type things, I would imagine. I can't really remember specifically, but I know I've seen it as a kid.
James, had you seen this movie before?
Yeah, I had seen this a long time ago, and there's a couple like snapshots in my mind, parts that I remembered of this film. And I remember the overall idea that it was like women in the workplace and Mr. Hart was a bad guy, because I remember when we were younger, Al, there was a show called Drexel's Class. And it starred Dabney Coleman, who plays Mr. Hart. And I remember thinking, oh, I know this guy. He's the bad guy from 9 to 5.
I had never seen 9 to 5, but I recognized him as the Hugh Hefner type in Dragnet. It's a pretty small role, but he like gets into it with Dan Aykroyd's character. And he's like, well, you're busy polishing your pennies. And that's always what I remember whenever I see him, that one random line from Dragnet.
Oh, yeah, he's a character actor. A lot of, like, that guy roles.
I was just going to say, in terms of people going on to other roles, one of my favorite TV shows that I love to binge watch, especially when I'm traveling for work, is Grace and Frankie, which I thought was very funny to pick up on whether or not their characters in 9 to 5 play into or transfer over into that TV show, which is very popular.
Which one is Grace and which one is Frankie?
Grace is Jane Fonda, and Frankie is Lily Tomlin.
And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, like they became friends or like they met on this movie, 9 to 5, and then they just stayed in touch and were friends all those years later to do that show together.
Interesting.
But the movie starts with the song, 9 to 5, by Dolly Parton, which is just a classic, iconic song that everybody loves, and I've been playing it like nonstop all week. It's just in my head. I mean, it's a hell of a catchy tune.
It's absolutely been in my head all week, and not just the song, but just the bass line.
Yeah.
We're going to have to play just a little bit of the chorus here. So let's just give them a little bit of it. Hit it, Dolly.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living.
I thought maybe you'd actually put the real clip in, but that's cool too.
Yeah.
Fine. Here's the real version.
Working 9 to 5.
No, again, that's me. Okay, here's the real version for real.
Working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. Barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it.
Yeah, that's been in my head all week. It's a rare thing that the lyrics actually kind of tell a coherent story, and it's very relevant to the film. I'm not sure if you wrote it for the film or...
She did.
Oh, she did, but, you know, it works as a companion to the film.
Yes, yes, and I think that was one of her conditions, her being Dolly Parton, that if she was going to do the movie, she wanted to write and perform the theme song, and they had no problem with that, and they heard her song, and everyone loved it immediately, because of course they did. And yeah, I mean, it's definitely meant to be a companion for the movie. And the movie itself starts with Judy, who is joining the workforce maybe for the first time. She was just divorced, and she's new to this office, and she's being shown around by Violet. Judy is Jane Fonda, and Violet is Lily Tomlin. Violet's been working at this office for 12 years, and she actually trained Mr. Hart, and now Mr. Hart is her boss. He's the VP. They also mentioned that there's this chairman of the board who's really the boss. And Violet says that in the 12 years that she's been working there, she's never once even seen him in person. And Mr. Hart, like you were saying, Courtney, is just sexist right out of the gate in his first meeting with Judy and Violet. Like, one of the first things he says is, "It's a shame you girls never learned about teamwork because you never played baseball or football."
Which is interesting, because I always feel like one of the things that I kind of get annoyed with in my job is I do work in an industry that's fairly male-dominated. And oftentimes, especially at business dinners, the conversation always turns to sports. And I could be a woman who likes sports, but let's just say most women do not follow sports as closely as men do. And so in a way, it's a little bit of an exclusive conversation. And I don't know if they're realizing it, probably not, but should be a little bit more open-minded about that.
Do they ever talk about, like, women's basketball or women's soccer leagues or stuff like that?
No.
You should bring that up. You should be like, "My favorite women's soccer player is," and then just see what they say to that.
Yeah, maybe. Or musicals, you know, what's your favorite musical? Maybe that.
There you go.
Fashion designer. See how long they can carry on the conversation.
Right. But then Mr. Hart asks Violet to buy his wife a present. And I'm going to assume that that's never happened to you, or has it?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, good, good. What exactly is Violet's title? She's like a senior office manager or something. Do they say it in the movie? Did I miss that?
No, they never mention exactly what she does, but she obviously has some, like, authority, but it's probably with no additional pay at all.
Right. She's an important person among the main staff, but not important enough to, like, have her own office. She's in the sea of cubicles, which I did think was a little bit interesting that even in 1980, they had, like, that open floor plan. I don't know if that was terribly common, but at every New York City office job I've had, they all have those open cubicles.
I think in the city, yeah. I think in a city setting, it's probably pretty common. I mean, one of the things I thought was interesting too about Violet, I think she's like a manager. I don't know if she's a senior manager. But if you noticed, when Judy was hired, remember she was grumbling about the fact that, oh, I had to take her and she doesn't have any experience and how did she get this job? Which I thought was kind of interesting because it kind of goes back to, you know, do women always support other women? And no, not always. I think there's, you know, some kind of resentment depending on positions and how people got there.
Sure, sure. I mean, that comes up with Dora Lee because mm-hmm. that's Dolly Parton's character. And there's a rumor going around that she's sleeping with Mr. Hart, and all of the other women in the office hate her because of that. And no one really wants to give her the time of day. But it turns out she's not sleeping with Mr. Hart, and Mr. Hart is just harassing her worse than he harasses everybody else.
And the reason why people think that Dora Lee is sleeping with Mr. Hart, it's incredibly sleazy. So it's something that seems to have happened shortly before the events of the film take place. But it seems like Mr. Hart told Dora Lee that there's some conference in, you know, whatever city. So let's book a hotel for us. You know, we have to go, and you're coming with me as my assistant. And then there was no conference, and he just booked like one hotel room for the two of them. them? Is that what seems to have happened?
They don't really go into that much detail, but something along those lines. There was a made-up conference.
But you have to give Dorley credit, because, I mean, the whole time I was watching her, I was like, she's really tactful in this incredibly uncomfortable, incredibly inappropriate situation. She doesn't make him feel bad even about his behavior. She just kind of like, oh, it's okay. And just keeps trying to move along to what she actually needs to do in her job or should be doing.
Like when he does the thing where he like knocks the pencils off his desk so he can look down her shirt. She's not an idiot. She plays dumb and is like, oh, don't worry, I'll get the pencils. She knows what he's doing. Yes, you're right. She's being tactful and she sort of plays it off as like she's just polite and southern. But like,
and trying to keep her job too.
Right, right.
I think if she was like really confrontational, you know, then that jeopardizes a job that she needs.
Yes, definitely. Just like in the little like tour of the office, there were some test of time things that we have to mention. Every desk has a typewriter, a dictaphone, and an adding machine, which is just kind of funny.
Yeah, my father, when he had a solo practice, practicing as a surgeon in a solo practice, his main office, they only used typewriters. This was through the 90s, and he finally got a letter in 2001 that said, "Dear Dr. Brief, we have one person employed at our company whose sole job is to process the paper bills that you send us. So as of, you know, whatever, like 90 days from now, we will no longer process any bills that you send us if they're not on computer. Sincerely, you know, Empire Blue Cross or something." So these typewriters were in use in business for a long time, at least with my father.
I mean, it definitely sounds like your dad was a holdout. And I would make fun of him for that, except good job, Dr. Brief, your dad, because he kept that person employed at, you know, Empire, Blue Cross, whatever, like throughout the 90s when they probably should have gotten laid off at some point in the 80s. So, you know, I guess he did a service there.
You're welcome, Al, on behalf of my dad.
He's one of my favorite Dr. Briefs, for sure.
I also like the Rolodex that they had. That's the kind of thing that I would argue that someone with a Rolodex could get a telephone number quicker than someone with the telephone in their pocket.
I disagree with that. If you can just look up like someone based on anything in your phone, it's going to be faster than trying to remember their last name. What if you don't remember their last name?
Well, that's different. I'm saying if you know their name, I'm saying you take out your phone out of your pocket, you unlock it, you have to scroll down to the phone book, you have to find the contacts, then you hit the search bar and you hit Alan, Noah. You know, I'm just saying you just flip to N. Oh, yeah, there's Alan, Noah.
I guess. But the other like big piece of outdated technology is the Xerox machine, which, yeah, offices still have Xerox machines. But this Xerox machine is something I have never seen anything that monstrous. I mean, it's like the size of a whole room.
Something like you'd see at Kinko's, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like a Kinko's, kind of.
Kind of, yeah.
You know, I would describe this scene as basically an updated version of, there's that classic I Love Lucy scene where Lucy and Ethel, they're at the chocolate factory on the conveyor belt and the chocolate's just getting more and more out of control and they can't keep up with it. It's updated for modern times, 1980. And back then, at the dawn of this kind of tech, there were a lot of, I don't know if it was unnecessarily complicated, but tech at this time just, it was not very user-friendly. You had to be one of those people that was, you know, quote, good with computers and that kind of stuff to figure this kind of things out. This Xerox machine, it's a series of just like panels and buttons. It sort of looks like the original Star Trek, you know, the 1960s versions where it's just a bunch of blinking lights and buttons to press. Like, there's no way to figure out what these are. And I think for years, I thought that Xerox machines were this complicated because of this scene.
Although, I think she was trying to stop it and she kept pressing a green button. So in my mind, from a user experience, wouldn't green always mean more,
right?
Or on?
And every button was unlabeled, too. So,
but I would just be looking for that red button. And I think that is what he presses in the end, doesn't he? A red button.
I don't remember, but I mean, that would make sense. That's a pretty obvious visual cue of green means go, red means stop. You know, yeah, Hart comes in and he yells at her for not knowing how to use this complicated machine, which is like, you know, a dick move. Like, it's her first day. The machine's gigantic. Like, you know, cut her a little slack.
There's one thing I love when Lily Tomlin does. When she's answering the phone, I love when she has this great, "This is Violet, please hold. This is Violet, please hold." When Lily Tomlin does it, it's so funny. But she's so capable at everything she's doing, and she actually thinks she's going to get promoted because there's a promotion coming up. And of course, who gets it? Not Violet, the person who's been there for 12 years, but a man that's only been there for, well, much less than her.
Right. And the salt in the wound is that when Hart is explaining why, he says, well, he's got a family to support. And Violet is a widow with four kids. So, you know, she's like, well, I also have a family to support. That shouldn't be the reason why someone gets a promotion anyway, but that reason doesn't hold any water. And then he's like, well, it's not my fault, but, you know, the customers prefer to deal with a man.
I thought it was a little bit too on the nose when he actually says it to her, but it's just obvious when, you know, she's passed over. But, you know, he says, it is because you are woman, not man, who would do job better. To be fair, I think by now I get it. Mr. Hart's a sexist pig.
Right, right. And that scene, Violet also, because she's so angry, she sort of like confronts Doralee about like, well, you're sleeping with the boss, so, you know, you're part of the problem too. And she's like, what? No, I'm not. And then Violet and Doralee and Judy all leave work. They go down to the local bar. They start drinking. And then they decide that they want to get high because Violet's son gave her a joint. And they all go to Doralee's house. They get very, very stoned on a marijuana cigarette. That's maybe what Judy calls it, or Doralee. I forget which one of them, but it just kind of made me laugh. But you're like, this marijuana.
Yeah, it was very interesting to see how the times have changed because, you know, as we're speaking, there's bills in the house to completely legalize marijuana. And when Violet takes out the joint, they're like, what are you doing? We can get in so much trouble. And, you know, it was not really an overreaction because you get the wrong cop back in 1980, you could really ruin your life with a joint.
I mean, but they're white, so they don't have that much to worry about, right?
You get the wrong cop that wants to book you for that, and for the rest of your life, you're going to be filling out a different box on your job applications. It was very striking that, like, you know, Violet was like, let's go in the bathroom and we'll smoke the joint in the stall. And they were terrified. Like, the other two were like, you're crazy.
I did read one piece of trivia that apparently Ronald Reagan saw this movie with Nancy in 1981, and he said he really, really liked the movie, and he thought it was very entertaining, except for the part where they used pot, and it was awful because now they're teaching kids that drugs are okay. But other than that, he really liked the movie.
Well, that was their big campaign, right? Dare, yeah. And just say no. I mean, one thing I thought was funny about Violet and her pot smoking is that, again, going back to Grace and Frankie is very much a pothead, constantly high, constantly walking around with her her joint. So it kind of spills into the updated version of their relationship.
Interesting. But while they're all sitting around high, they start talking about how they want to kill Mr. Hart. And there's a fantasy sequence with Judy where she like dreams about hunting him down and shooting him. And I was like, wait a second. What kind of movie is this? This is weird. I was like kind of taken by that. I thought there was like this weird left turn. But then after her fantasy, then Doralee has a different fantasy about killing Mr. Hart. As soon as that fantasy started, I'm like, okay, so then we're going to see a third one, right? Because after Doralee's fantasy where she like hog-ties him, then we have Violet's fantasy where she's like Snow White, kind of, and she poisons Mr. Hart's coffee.
Well, to be fair, she's like the just off Snow White, so you can't get sued. Like, there's a deer who's not, you can't prove it's Bambi. Can't prove it. A deer could look similar, you know. It's not dearest. I guess it's probably dearest a little to say that all deer look alike.
I don't think dearest is a word or a thing.
My God, to deny deercism? Wow. You are the worst enemy of deer-ism or deer-ism? I don't know. But whatever it is, you're an enemy of it.
Sure. I don't know. I thought this was like a really strange departure from what the movie was and what I was expecting the movie to be. Am I the only one who
thought
that way?
I thought it was weird, but then I was like, but they're all high. So I guess they're just going with that, like, what does your brain do when you're high kind of thing?
I guess.
You know, I actually looked at it similar to that because I actually think this film has a somewhat anti-marijuana theme to it, because everything that happens after they take this joint, like, they have these fantasies of murder, and that leads to what happens in the next scene, which is it's the next day. They have the time of their lives. They come in. They're like, oh, man, we got to do this more often. That was so much fun. And then Violet, she's going to fix Mr. Hart's coffee, and then all of a sudden she's pouring the sugar. And just like in her fantasy where she poured some poison in Mr. Hart's coffee, she realizes by accident that she has poured rat poison in Mr. Hart's coffee. She doesn't realize it before she hands it to Mr. Hart, but Mr. Hart takes the rat poison mixed coffee, and then she leaves him. And Mr. Hart, he happens to fall out of his chair. We had seen before in the film that the chair is kind of rickety, but he falls down, hits his head, and passes out. And Violet comes in and, of course, assumes that she's poisoned and killed him, just like she had been fantasizing about while she was high.
Right. Then they go to the hospital. There's a big misunderstanding. Someone else dies, and they overhear the doctors and the nurses talking about that. So then Violet decides she has to, like, steal the corpse, because if they do an autopsy, they'll find out that he was poisoned. And the three of them are running from the law with this corpse in the trunk. And now I'm even more confused. I'm like, wait a second. I thought this was a movie about, like, women in the office, like, trying to prove that they're good at work. Like, what is this movie?
I did feel like that whole sequence was a little, like, couldn't they have just cut this all out and just, like, somehow he found out about, like, their accident and then, like, just gotten into that part where they kidnap him? Because that's what I remember, the kidnapping. And that's why I was, like, confused. I was like, wait, what's happening now about a corpse?
Yeah, it goes on for, like, a really long time.
Yeah, a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'll admit that I laugh, like, when they get pulled over by a cop and then Violet is still wearing the doctor's uniform that she stole from the hospital. And she's like, I have to get to the hospital. She's sick. And the cop says, which one of you is sick? And then they do that thing
she
where...
She is.
Yeah, exactly. They both say it, like, in unison, I am.
Or I am, yeah.
She is. And, like, I mean, that's kind of an old gag, but it was kind of funny. But it really goes nowhere, because then they get to the hospital, they drop off the corpse that they stole, which was the wrong body.
Not that they stole, that Violet stole, which is a big distinction, because there's a part where Violet's like, come on, girls, we're all in this together. No. At this point, the only one who's done anything possibly criminal is Violet, who may have poisoned her boss and may have stolen a corpse. Well, she did steal a corpse.
Yes, she very much did steal the corpse, which, you know, that's not cool and certainly illegal, I assume. I assume there's a law against that, probably.
I think it's called body snatching, so yeah.
Okay.
I will say I agree with you that the hospital chase was way too long, but I think there was a good payoff, because what they finally do with the body, they dump it in the bathroom of a hospital, and then you see one of the custodians, and they just lean in and they just casually talk to one of their coworkers, and they say, hey, Bobby, we got another stiff in the John. I just thought it was funny the way that woman said it.
I guess. Then they show up to work the next day and they see Mr. Hart, because he wasn't poisoned. He just banged himself on the head and he's fine. And they all think he's dead. So they're like, wah, 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 what? And they are talking about it in the women's room. They being Judy, Violet, and Doralee. Like, well, we thought we poisoned him, but we didn't poison him. And he's fine now. And, you know, it all worked out from stealing that corpse. And they're having this very private conversation in the bathroom, which they shouldn't be doing. They've looked under the stalls and didn't see any feet, so they think that they're alone. But Roz is hiding out in one of the stalls. And Roz, she's a snitch who works in the office.
Yeah, she's a spy.
Right.
And his kind of dirty deeds doer, right? Like she's the one who says, oh, you can't have personal items on your desk. You have to wear certain things, like very militant in her attitude.
Yeah, she's the enforcer. Like Hart comes up with all of the terrible rules, and then Roz is the one who goes out there and like cracks the whip, basically.
Yeah.
And she's taking notes in the ladies' room, writing them on toilet paper. Which I was like, there's got to be a better way to be a spy than writing on like one ply office toilet paper.
You think?
I would think.
You could just remember that they said, you know, we poisoned the boss. Just remember that. I think you just remember that.
Right. I don't know that the notes written on toilet paper make like for more damning of a case.
Mr. Hart, the girls, what was it they said they did? And you know, you pull out some crumpled toilet paper. Oh, yeah, they said they poisoned you. That's it.
Well, he does say that, though. He's like, they actually said that? And she's like, it says it right here.
Yeah, I guess for that gag, it worked. But what does he do with this information? He does not immediately do what any sane person does and goes, oh, my God, someone tried to put rat poison in my coffee. I'm going to call the police immediately. No. He now decides, oh, I completely own these women.
He uses that as leverage to finally try to get Doralee to sleep with him. And she refuses again. We meet Doralee's husband. She's a happily married woman and she's a respectable woman and she has no interest in sleeping with her boss. And he's like, well, then I'm going to call the police and you're all going to go to jail. So then she ends up tying him up with the phone line because it's a landline, because it's 1980. And this is part of her fantasy of tying up Mr. Hart. And then Judy comes in and Hart convinces her to untie him. And then he's like, well, now I'm leaving and I'm going to call the cops for real. And Judy grabs the gun from Doralee's purse because Doralee carries a gun with her at all times. She shoots the gun at Mr. Hart with her eyes closed, which is not a good way to shoot a gun, I would imagine. She happens to just shatter some glass. Luckily, this all happens like right after 5 and the entire office has cleared out. There's not a single person who stays to like 5:10 in this office. So luckily no one else is a witness to her shooting at the boss. But that was a thing that happened in her fantasy, was that she shot Hart.
And where's the bullet go after that? It has to be evidence, right? It goes through the glass.
Yes.
Is it like embedded in someone's desk? And they're just like, huh, that's interesting. Nice day when they come in.
Well, this happens on a Friday. And then when we see them back at the office on Monday, you see someone like replacing that window pane. But it seems like no questions are asked.
Yeah.
My guess is that they filed a memo to someone in that corporation that just said, fix this window. That's it. And someone else, replace this desk here. And I'll bet it was all done at 8 a.m. on Monday morning.
And someone else removed the bullets from the drywall. Don't ask any questions.
No, they just said there's a hole in the wall. Put a frame up there. I want a poster there in an hour. 10 years later, when that company went out of business, I think they found all that stuff. They're like, huh?
Maybe.
Well, one of the things you find out is that any memos that have Mr. Hart's signature on them, just automatically, no questions asked, get implemented, right? So they could have had a lot of influence in fixing the repairs.
That's true. And that is what they end up doing. But first, they basically end up kidnapping Hart in his house. They have him chained up. Violet comes up with this contraption to keep him in the room, but allows him to walk around and go to the bathroom. And earlier in the movie, we saw her fixing the garage door opener at her house. So that's basically what they have Hart connected to.
It's like a human claw. That's what I feel. Like, I kind of loved it because it can kind of navigate and move back and forth. But as soon as you want to draw it back up, it just like snaps back up with him in it.
Right. And like the gag is that he's in what kind of looks like S&M chains sort of a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they have him tied up and they're kind of like, now what? And throughout the movie, you've been hearing something about the Ajax Corporation and something that Mr. Hart has been doing very secretly. And he's been also whispering to other people about this scheme he's working on. And Violet finds out that basically he's ripping off the company for a lot of money. And she's going to be able to prove it by getting some invoice from New York. Now, today it would take 1 second, but in 1980, it's going to take 6 weeks to get the invoice that is going to prove that Mr. Hart is a crook. Basically, he's been charging the company like $1 million for equipment that doesn't exist, and he's been pocketing all of that money.
Right. It's an embezzlement scheme. But like, I have a big problem with this "it takes 6 weeks" thing. Their excuse is they're changing the computer systems, so that's why it's going to take this long. Like, okay, fine. But are they telling Hart this? Because they like confront him about the Ajax scheme, and he's like, well, you can't prove it. And she's like, well, yes, I can. And then she finds out that it's going to take 6 weeks to get the paperwork. But he doesn't know that because he's chained up at home. So all she has to say is, well, we've got the proof. We're going to, you know, the authorities, you better confess or whatever. But it seems like he knows that they are waiting for this paperwork. I don't know. It just felt like a convenient, quote unquote, thing to keep him tied up longer, but also stupid.
I agree. There should have been something where Doralee accidentally says it a little too loud and, you know, you can't keep me here for 6 weeks. And, you know, then they go, oh, yeah, we can. Because that's pretty much what they do. They decide to keep him locked up for 6 weeks. And it is pretty funny that he says, I'm the boss. People are going to notice that the boss isn't there. And, you know, interestingly enough, nobody notices. Well, almost nobody.
Roz with her eagle eye, right?
Yeah, they send her to Paris for 6 months.
6 weeks.
6 weeks. Yeah, whatever.
Oh, they sent her for training, right? Languages?
They get rid of Roz, and she's more than happy to go, especially because she gets a memo saying that Mr. Hart requested this.
Right, and they do say earlier in the movie that Doralee can sign Mr. Hart's name, which is a thing that I've heard of that secretaries do for their bosses. They sign their boss's name. So Roz is happy to get on a TWA flight, by the way, and go to France. So they got rid of her. Mr. Hart's wife is gone. She wanted to go on some cruise for 2 months, so she's out of the picture. And while the three women have the office to themselves, they start changing things and they get rid of Mr. Hart's rules that you can't have plants on your desk or pictures at your desk. And he fired some poor woman for no reason, and they hire her back, and they implement equal pay for the men and the women, and they put a daycare in the office, and they have this part-time work where people can share the job if they want to work different shifts. And all of this, I think, is really interesting, and it shows that these women are so smart, but it's a montage. Like, all of that stuff that I just described goes by in like a 30-second montage of like, here's how we're improving things. I thought that was like way too fast.
So now a lot of progressive, you know, really high profile companies, these are all what you'd expect them to have, and they do have. But back in the 80s, I wonder what percentage of companies actually were making these changes.
That's a very good point. Yeah, I mean, like, was this movie sort of suggesting things that were progressive,
new, right,
brand
yeah.
new? Like, I genuinely don't know. If any of our listeners do know, if you're a little older than us, you remember these things, or you've heard from your parents or whatever, tweet at us at Test of Time Pod and let us know. I'd be curious to know. But I think it's interesting that we're seeing that these three women are better at running the office than Mr. Hart. And I saw some quote from Jane Fonda where she says something like, the idea was that you can run an office without a boss, but you can't run an office without the secretaries. And I thought that was interesting. And you do see that in this movie, but pretty much only in this montage.
That I can totally relate to. I mean, I have seen offices where they don't have secretaries. And what ends up happening, I think, in some cases is it goes back to the female employees. I mean, not as blatant as getting coffee, but, oh, can you help me with this? Can you order? And sometimes it's funny because sometimes it does go to the men too. So I guess it's not always sexist. But I think the secretaries do have a role in keeping things running. And they're kind of overlooked sometimes, especially when companies are trying to be a little cheap.
Like
that they don't value that. But there's a lot of important like office culture things that they do take care of.
Right. I feel like now the word secretary is fallen out of favor, and they use things like, you know, office assistant or office manager, administrative assistant,
executive assistant.
Sure.
I mean, executive assistants, they always blow my mind. I've interacted with a few of them for various jobs, and they're like the go-to people in some cases, more so than, you know, the executives of the company. They just know everything. They know how to get stuff done.
Yeah. I filled in for an executive assistant once, like early in my career, like for, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks. And I was horrifically overwhelmed. I was like, I don't know how anyone can fill in for this woman ever. In like 2 weeks, I thought I ruined everything. She just knew so much. It's a hard job to replace.
I would also say some of, you know, on a positive note, some of what I've seen is I do think people, if they're smart, they appreciate the job they do and will bend over backwards to do really nice things for those people to make sure that they like their job, make sure that they're going to stay, because to find someone who can do that job and do it well is tough. So if you have an executive assistant and they're doing an amazing job, cut out the sexist, you know, chauvinistic talk. Make sure that you're paying them well, that they have flexibility if they need it, you know, that you're giving them the benefits to make them want to stay in the job.
Definitely. That's good advice, people.
So eventually Mrs. Hart, she actually comes home a little bit early. So one day when the women are at work, Mrs. Hart comes home and she frees him. But interestingly enough, Mr. Hart does not tell Mrs. Hart, like, help, honey, like, these women kidnapped me. He convinces his wife that he's in some kind of crazy new wacky modern day 1980s exercise contraption. And that's all he tells her. He just says, thank you very much for getting me out of the contraption, and I'm back to work.
Right. And then he immediately somehow legitimizes the whole Ajax thing. He like buys the equipment that was supposed to be there using his personal money that he stole.
It is his personal money, because he mentions at one point, it cost me a pretty penny to make it right, too. You probably had to pay back like 70% of what he stole just to buy all the stuff there.
And then he goes back to the office, weirdly, not right to the police.
Well, he does want one beautiful moment of absolute power. Like, he is about to get them thrown in jail, and he wants to see their faces. He's that kind of guy that would actually call them in to see the look on their face when he calls the police.
I guess he's that twisted. But before he has a chance to call the police, he gets a call that the chairman of the board is there in person, and he wants to see Hart. And the reason he wants to see Hart is because he's so impressed with all of the changes that have happened over the last 6 weeks and how they've increased productivity and their numbers are through the roof because of all the changes that the chairman thinks are from Hart, but are really from Violet and Judy and Dora Lee. So, of course, he takes the credit for all of their ideas. We saw him do that earlier in the movie. He took the credit for Violet's color coding system thing. And so he's happy to take all of the credit for all of their work. He at one point says, oh, you know, Violet, she's my right hand. She can explain something, because he has no idea what it is. But then the chairman is so pleased, he decides to send Hart to run their new operation in Brazil, which is like the worst possible thing that Hart could imagine, being sent to Brazil. I mean, you've been to Brazil, James. Isn't it like a beautiful country?
Yes, it is absolutely beautiful. And I mean, this is something that Brazilians tell me a lot, that there are a lot of people around the world that think that Brazil is basically the Amazon rainforest. So it is definitely an outdated and incorrect stereotype. Brazil is awesome and modern. I mean, you know, there is an Amazon rainforest.
I mean, presumably the office that they're setting up would be in a city in Brazil, not in the middle of the rainforest.
Well, unless it's in Manaus, which is a city that they just like built in the middle of the rainforest. So it could be that.
Maybe it is, because the movie ends with, there's text on screen that tells you what happens to the characters. And Hart is kidnapped by some, is it Amazonians, people in the jungle?
Jungle people.
Jungle people. He's never seen again. Violet gets Hart's old job. Judy falls in love with the Xerox guy. And then Dorley leaves the company to become a country and western singer. Get it, audience? Because it's played by Dolly Parton. Get it? Get it? I thought that was way too on the nose.
That's exactly what I thought, too. I was like, oh, because, yeah. I mean, we already knew it's Dolly Parton. So.
Right. I mean, that's a hat on a hat. So that's the end of the movie. So, Courtney, our very special guest, do you think that 9 to 5 stands the test of time?
I definitely think it does. There's a few parts, like we were talking about when they're at the hospital, that, you know, are a little weird plot-wise. I don't know if it really has to do with the age of the movie, because some movies just have that. But I can't really say that there are things other than, like, you know, some of the technology and things like that. But the issues that they're bringing up certainly exist today. You know, still don't have a female president. We're getting there with a female vice president. But
right.
I think sexism continues to not get the focus and attention that it needs. And that's an important thing to, you know, to bring up in movies and address. And I can't think of any recent movies. Bombshell, which we watched not that long ago, was one of those movies that kind of addressed similar themes. So I think it's still relevant. It stands the test of time.
That's one vote stands the test of time. What does the other Noah think?
I mean, there are many Noahs, but only two on this podcast. I really have to say that the whole thing about the fantasies of killing the boss and then stealing the corpse and then kidnapping Hart, like, that really, really bothered me, because I just felt like I want to see these women do a better job at work than Hart, and I want to see them do it, like, honestly, like, in a relatable way. Like, the whole beginning part of the movie where Hart is being so sexist and treating them awfully, like, that is real. Like, that's, like, relatable stuff that's happening. And then it just takes this weird turn into, like, slapstick comedy and, like, oh, now we're going to tie him up and he's in S&M gear. Ha 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 ha. And it's like, wait, that's how they do it? That's how they outsmart him? I just felt like that was kind of a crappy way to show how smart they are and how resourceful they are by, like, kidnapping their boss.
Yeah, but I don't think it was that. I think getting him on the embezzlement, I think even though that didn't work out in the end, that's a more smart way to go about getting him.
Yeah, I get that. But I just feel like the way they sort of get from A to B to C, like, it starts in reality and then goes into, like, silly movie territory, you know? That kind of bothered me, because I feel like, why didn't they get rid of Hart the way that they got rid of Roz? Like, using their smarts to get him out of the office for a while. And then let's see more of the changes that they make and the equal pay and the daycare and all of those things. And you could still do that in a funny way. Like, it doesn't need to be preachy. Like, I saw another quote from Jane Fonda where she said that in early versions of the script, it was too serious and she felt like it was preachy and she was on a soapbox and she didn't want to make that kind of movie. And I respect that, but I feel like there's a way to do it in a comedy that could have been a little bit more clever and relatable and then maybe could have had more of an impact. But that said, clearly, this movie did have a huge impact because it's still well known. It was a huge box office success. It had a TV spinoff that lasted for 5 seasons. I didn't know that. I found that in my Wikipedia research. There was a Broadway musical. Like, people know this movie. People love this movie. And I think that it does resonate because of all the issues that you said. You know, like, it's about women dealing with sexist bosses, creeps, assholes who steal your ideas and treat you like shit and are happy to take all the credit. And all of that stuff is still relevant. And even though I don't love a lot of the plot mechanics of how it worked, I still think that the movie does stand the test of time because of what it's saying, sort of in a big picture sense. So I'm going to say that it does stand the test of time. James, what do you think?
There are a lot of things I like in this film, and basically it's most of the cast. I think Lily Tomlin is hysterical as always. Dolly Parton is just wonderful. We haven't mentioned how wonderful Dolly Parton is, not just as an actress, but as a person. Famously, she donated $1 million recently to a university to help coronavirus vaccine research. Have you ever heard of the Dolly Parton? It's the Imagination Library.
No.
Any parent in America, when your baby's born, you sign up for this thing. It's not financial need dependent. And if you sign up for the Imagination Library, you get like a free book sent to you like every month until your kid's like 2 years old. And this is founded by Dolly Parton. The woman is an absolute saint. I recently saw an interview with Stephen Colbert when he was interviewing Barack Obama. And one of his questions, he just turns and he goes, "Why hasn't Dolly Parton been given the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is the highest honor a non-military citizen can get?" And Obama was like, "Wait, you're serious? I just assumed she had one." And he's like, "I'm going to call Joe and like, we're going to fix this." So 100% Dolly Parton is as charming as ever. She is wonderful. And she's a good actress. I was thinking maybe she'd be kind of cheesy, but she was great in this film. That being said, I think that Jane Fonda's character is kind of useless. When you first meet her, she's this fish out of water. She kind of dresses like she's from like an Amish country, and she's going into the big city. That's an interesting character, but they never really play that up. And we didn't even talk about it. There's this arc that she's divorced and her husband, her ex-husband served her divorce papers. So she's very sad. But at the very end, she kicks him out because she can have a divorce and she can make it on her own. And the very end, her epilogue, her like win is that she marries the Xerox guy. I just kind of thought it was a little lame for a film that's about female empowerment, that like it was one of those, all she needed was a man at the end and love. Something else I loved about Violet, her redemption at the end, it was fantastic. I mean, she becomes vice president of the company and, you know, presumably does very well for herself. Another thing I like about this film, Dabney Coleman. He is incredibly dislikable in this film. And I mean that to his credit. And, you know, there's a lot of funny things in this film. There are a lot of boring things. I think the entire hospital sequence is boring. And, you know, Al, I agree with a lot of what you're saying, that the film has a lot of flaws. And I agree with a lot of what you're saying, Courtney, that, you know, the film really, really stands up in its themes. Unfortunately, I think the plot itself is kind of stupid. I wish there was a better way that these women kind of come out on top. I like the memo scene. I like that they change those things, but I don't like the chairman of the board character. I don't like the kidnapping angle. I just wish it was more clever and funny. And I don't think that the three women like really go through much of an arc. I think that Violet does, but the other two women are just kind of there. Doralee's a fun character, and I didn't really care for Judy. So I'm going to say the film does not stand the test of time. It's got its moments, but I just wish the plot was better.
Okay, we get it. You love sexism, and you know, that's your prerogative.
And same way that when you didn't like The Prince of Egypt, you prefer films where the slaves don't get freed. But, you know, I mean, that's okay. We each, I guess, have our own quirks.
Right. So before we say goodbye, Courtney, there's something that occurs to me. You have been on the podcast to talk about Sleepless in Seattle, My Best Friend's Wedding, Silence of the Lambs, Moonstruck, and now 9 to 5. So that would be five times. So hang on one second here.
Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. What is it? What is it? Is it going to be the same thing we've given everyone else, or is it going to be something different?
Here you go.
Oh, a sweatshirt. A Test of Time sweatshirt.
Not just any Test of Time sweatshirt. What does it say underneath?
Five Timers Club. Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Just so we're totally clear, this does count as your Christmas present and Hanukkah present.
And birthday.
And birthday.
Okay.
And anniversary. So congratulations. Welcome to the club.
Thank you. I can't wait to wear it proudly.
Thank you. Thank you. You can wear it to work next time you're at like a big executive meeting where you're the only woman there. You should wear that sweatshirt.
I will. underneath my jacket. We do that because in my gym class, there's like, what's an air horn?
I think it's an air horn, yeah.
And so it's Alan's favorite thing to do when he's making fun of me.
I love that sound effect.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on the show, Courtney. Thank you for joining us again
thank
for the
you for
fifth
having
time.
Me. It was a pleasure, especially as my fifth movie being 9 to 5, which I love.
You are welcome. Anytime, next time a movie strikes your fancy that you want to talk about, you let me know. I'll talk it over with James. If James approves, we'll have you back on the show.
Will do.
That's going to do it for us this week. Come back next week for our annual Christmas episode when we will be discussing Elf. It's the perfect movie to talk about on Christmas, isn't it?
Oh yeah, Elf is a classic. But let's see if it stands up to the test of time.
Let's see if it does. As always, we want to keep the conversation going with you guys. Talk to us at Test of Time Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can email us at thetestoftimepodcast@gmail.com. We love hearing from you, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.
Bye.